How did you get so interested in North Korean comic books?
Well, it started sort of by accident. I was researching North Korean folktales because I collect South Korean folktales. And I was doing a comparison. I wanted to see if the North Koreans kept older versions because they tend to be much more traditionalists. And I ran across a North Korean educational website for North Koreans living abroad. And on the same page where they had some picture books of Korean fairy tales, they had a couple of these comic books. And I found them to be quite fascinating. In those days, you could log on without a password. And I read the comics. And that's when I first began to be interested, but also curious in both the academic and personal sense, because my own connection with comics goes way back to when I was a kid before I could read.
And you grew up in South Korea, right?
I grew up in South Korea in the 60s during the Park Chung-hee administration. And that was a time when comic books were considered one of the great social evils, equivalent to alcoholism, gambling, and prostitution. So I would hang out in the local, they called them manhwa-bang. It's a little hole-in-the-wall store, which was about a little larger than this room, that would have had comic books plastered on all the walls. And you would go in there and pay by the hour, or you could pay a flat rate and stay there all day. And that's where I learned how to read visually.
So this was a formative influence. A formative part of your childhood was reading these comic books in South Korea.
Yes, and I think a lot of what I learned about literature and film, I actually, if I think back on it, I actually sort of absorbed through flipping through these comic books. And I still remember very clearly that since I couldn't read, I had to have some guideline for how long I would look at a page. So I watched other kids who did read, and I timed my page turning to correspond with theirs so I could imitate reading. But I was really looking just at the pictures.
So why were these comic books in South Korea considered a great social evil?
Well, part of it was that popular in Korean classical culture, there's a very strong distinction between folk culture and high culture. It's sort of what we do in the West also. But comic book illustration, especially the cartoony, comedic style of illustration, was always considered the lowliest form of art because anyone could do that. It wasn't considered a form of art that required any kind of training. There was no real formal aesthetic for it. And most of the people who did those things were people who were marginal in society at the time. And also, the place where you could access comics was where all the juvenile delinquents hung out.
Sounds very much like the way Americans used to talk about comic books.
Yeah, in the old days, I guess before comics became collector's items and, you know, collected in Mylar acid-free bags, back in the day when you would pick up comics at the drugstore and roll them up and carry them in your back pocket, it was sort of like that. But in South Korea, because of the poverty, no one could afford to buy a comic book. Comic books were published in multiple volumes, and they had to be rented. So it would have been like a Blockbuster Video of that era. And there were romance comics for women and girls, but they would generally send some male relative to the comic book store when it closed, and then they would rent those romance series overnight, and the women would read them and return them in the morning. So it's a curious culture. Until probably the late 80s, Korean comics weren't generally sold to the direct consumer. Bookstore owners had to go and buy them in multiple sets. And it wasn't until a comic book called Wayin Gudan, about a baseball team. And Wayin Gudan translates literally as like the alien baseball team. And it was a group of social marginals, like mixed race children, a guy from the country, and people who we would classify as, I guess, mentally challenged, right? And they become the superstar baseball team, and that became the most popular comic book in Korean history, and it turned the whole culture around.
So now you are a scholar of Korean culture and Korean folktales, and you study North Korean comic books. And I'm curious about how you got into the subject because, of course, North Korean culture, North Korea itself is one of the most isolated countries in the whole world. I mean, it's very hard to find out what's really happening in that country.
Yeah, things are a little more accessible now, but part of what I'm doing now goes back to a journal that's published by Harvard's Korea Institute called Azalea. It's edited by David McCann and Lee Young-jun. And they wanted to do a special North Korea issue. And the magazine is a beautiful magazine. And they wanted to make sure that it had lots of visual representations in it. And I suggested, because I was translating a North Korean short story, that perhaps we could do a special section. So I ended up editing the special section on North Korea. And I happened to have color photocopies of some of Great General Mighty Wing. And when Young-jun saw those, he said, we have to put them in the journal. And I had also found lots of North Korean postcards, holiday postcards from the New Year season, which were really quite poignant because they weren't the kinds of holiday cards you would expect. They were images, some of them were typical, like, you know, Victory Gates and the usual socialist realist type of art. But some of them were very poignant things like potato trucks, a formation of potato trucks going down to a snowy field. And they reflected North Korea's drought and the poverty and the starvation in a poignant way. We weren't allowed to print those because one of the funding agencies in Korea said, we can't have anything associated with North Korean propaganda. But comic books were under their radar. They said, that's okay. And Mighty Wing is probably, of all those visual images, the most propagandistic that I had found. But it was kind of ironic. So in a sense, in South Korea, comic books were no longer a social evil. They were taken for granted. So North Korean comics fell in that category too. And that's how I started more formally looking at those. And eventually, I was able to get probably 30 or 40 of them brought out by people who were visiting Pyongyang. And I started cataloging them and translating the ones that I found interesting at the time. And since then, I've been slowly developing an archive, which I hope to put online in the near future.
So why do you find North Korean comics interesting?
This goes back to my childhood again. Since I grew up in the Park Chung-hee administration, one of the things that was commonplace for school-age children was the presence of what we would classify as propaganda. They were national educational initiatives. And some of them are very pragmatic and ones we would find fairly typical. Like, you know, we had our Say No to Drugs campaign. In South Korea, when I was a child, the schools had educational campaigns like don't pick up explosives or beware of unexploded shells, because there were really shells left over from the Korean War. And farmers and kids would actually be blown up periodically. So there were campaigns like that. There were also things like personal hygiene campaigns. And in the Korean schools, the children would then do posters with pastel crayon. And that's a whole cultural, beautiful cultural representation. And at the same time, you would find comic books that were published by the government that did similar things. And this was the same era when, say, in the United States, a lot of Vietnam War-era military manuals were done by comic book artists. So I have an old one where you learn how to disassemble and clean an M16, and it's done by Neil Adams, it looks like.
So there is, I suppose we could call this a propaganda element to it. I mean, propaganda, if we consider that as, you know, trying to sort of pass on the dominant cultural values of the government.
Yes.
And you're saying that also applies to North Korean comic books?
Right. So when I saw the North Korean comics, what struck me immediately was they felt like South Korean propaganda comics of the 60s. And of course, I'm talking about comics that came out in the 90s and after the year 2000. So that time gap was also very curious to me. And part of the thing that's very interesting about North Korea is if you look at images of North Korea outside Pyongyang, or actually even Pyongyang itself, they really are quite reminiscent of South Korea in the 60s.
So you're, it's almost as if there's a time gap.
It's like a time capsule. And the North Korean, I think the poverty and the lack of development has sort of suspended them in that era. But a lot of the ideological things that we associate with military dictatorship are profoundly illustrated there as well. And the thing that really struck me about the North Korean comics, though, was that on the one hand, they did have explicitly educational propaganda, like how school children could identify potential spies, how to look for little behavioral clues that would tell you somebody was a foreign agent, right? Those kinds of things. But also the value of studying. There's a great piece of animation, actually, about a little boy who isn't doing his homework and he doesn't know how to use his protractor. And then he falls asleep and he has a dream in which he's in charge of a missile battery and he has to shoot at this invading American naval force, but he has to aim by getting the angle right with the protractor. And because he can't use it properly, he keeps missing. Mm-hmm. And his whole nation is in danger.
So yeah. I sense that there's a recurring theme here, which is watch out for the invaders from abroad.
Watch out for foreign invaders. And everything you do as a child is relevant to protecting our homeland.
So who are the invaders that are considered the enemy?
So if you looked at the graphic novel called The Crystal Key, there's a representation early on where you see these sea pirates, the seafaring pirates who have heard about this precious healing water that this village has. And when you see them, to an American, the representation looks kind of like, hippies, or they have long greasy hair and big noses and wear headbands. But to a North Korean, the long hair, the headband, and the big nose represents Americans. And the fact that they're seafaring pirates means that's the American Seventh Fleet. And so any North Korean would immediately know that these are a representation of American invaders, and they are after the most precious resource that we have, which is water. That comic book came out in the mid-90s during the height of the drought.
So are Americans the most feared enemy, or South Koreans or Japanese?
I think North Korea has been making quite a lot of headway in terms of its diplomacy with South Korea, although every year some major disaster occurs, as you can see from following the news. But in its recent history, of course, the Americans and the UN were initially bundled together, but because the major military foreign presence in that region is American, they have been specified as the generic enemy. If you look at the literary representations and the images from Great General Mighty Wing, you'll see that those spiders have big noses, very weird in the comic book. But they're also wearing Western-style helmets, and their spider web is shown in such a way that it looks sort of like the UN logo instead of the lines of the cartographic lines overlapping at the North Pole. You have the spider web intersecting at the home of the Spider King. And so that long nose character is the Americans, who really are the most prominent force in the UN. And then those wasps are drawn to look like the Japanese colonial era forces. And they have the stereotypical mustache, and the hats they wear are from World War II Japanese uniforms.
So sort of fascinating cross-cultural combination here. So you've mentioned the Great General Mighty Wing. He's a honeybee, is he?
He's a honeybee. And he's the heroic honeybee who advises the queen to create an aqueduct instead of squandering her resources to build herself a country house, which the other the other officer who's a honeybee recommends to the queen. And the building of the country house is one of those examples of high-level corruption that the North Koreans always sort of forefront, because on the one hand it refers back to the Soviet era corruption where lots of party officials had their dachas, their country, private country homes, and had lots of parties and things out there. But the North Korean stereotype of South Koreans is that the wealthiest South Koreans also have private country residences where they do all sorts of, I guess, hedonistic activities. And so for the other character, Xing Xing, to recommend that to the queen is immediately understood by an adult North Korean as a kind of sinister form of corruption. To a child, it's really sort of training the child to recognize that kind of corruption. Anything that gets directed at the self is corrupt. Anything that is for the good of the nation as a whole is positive.
But it's also interesting thinking about the animal that was chosen to be the hero here, the honeybee, who, of course, works in a collective, but yet also ultimately serves the queen, the paramount leader. And I'm assuming that's not an accident to see this in a North Korean comic book.
Yeah, I guess from our point of view, the beehive imagery would be like what the collective, you know, consciousness or the worker as part of a collective, right? We would see that sort of negatively, but you have to remember that, like I come from Poughkeepsie, and the logo for the city of Poughkeepsie is a beehive, and what it really represents is hard work for the sake of the community, you know, working together in a constructive way. And so in North Korea, that has become a sort of national level image. And also the notion that the great leader, who we know is actually more like a patriarch, is now represented as a maternal figure.
As the queen.
Yes.
The queen bee, which is fascinating. So how do you explain that?
Well, part of it is that Kim Il-sung is the great leader. But at the same time, if you look at the imagery, he's also given very nurturing imagery. So he's also like the mother of the country. And later, what you see is images of Kim Il-sung and his son Kim Jong-il, and then Kim Jong-il's mother. And you'll see posters of the three of them together. So what you have is, instead of the trinity that we associate with, say, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, what you have is father, mother, and son. Hmm. But what it does is it gives you I guess, a complete lineage of authority ranging from what we would consider as masculine authority all the way to the nurturing maternal authority.
So what we often hear about in terms of North Korean culture and how some of these political messages are conveyed is, I mean, there is this personality cult of the leader. So it sounds like you're saying that those values filter down into the comic books?
Well, what you see is they play out in literature, and then they play out in the comic books. And when you get to the comic books, it's hard to draw a parallel. But I was trying to figure out what analogy I could give to explain Mighty Wing, and what I came up with eventually was it would be as if our children were reading Mickey Mouse comics to be educated in proper moral and ethical values.
Hmm.
Now, in the West, that sort of thing does happen. I mean, there are some Latin American Marxist critics who have pointed out that Uncle Scrooge comics actually train American kids in monopoly capitalism. And we don't really see it that way. But I suppose if you look at it carefully, you know, Uncle Scrooge is a monopoly capitalist, and everything he does is based on spending as little money as possible for the maximum exploitation of labor, right? So if you turn this around and turned it into, say, a state campaign to use what we would classify as funny animals, or, you know, like a Pikachu character, that's what Mighty Wing is. He's cute and attractive, and he's heroic in a masculine way that appeals to young boys. And at the same time, following his story really trains you in the national ideology. So it's very elegant. And I can imagine, you know, these are comic books that are read by the future leaders of North Korea. And of course, a lot of those things that we absorb as children at that level, we sort of internalize. They become part of our unconscious motivations.
Do you have any sense of how popular these comic books, how popular a character like Mighty Wing is in North Korea?
Mighty Wing really is sort of like the Mickey Mouse of North Korea, because that book was published in color, and the volume I translated is 200 pages. It's 200 pages. That was the second volume. There are more than 400 pages of that graphic novel. And that book was brought out from Pyongyang. Now, there are other comic books you can get now in some of the Chinese cities near North Korea. And they're printed on a different kind of paper. Their binding is better. And my guess is that those were very clearly either printed or reprinted for export. Whereas some of those others on my website, like Crystal Key and Mighty Wing, those were clearly made for domestic consumption because they're on cheaper paper. Their print technology is a little inferior. And the copies I got were actually read quite thoroughly. They had been read many times. They had passed through many hands before they were brought out of the country.
So probably comic books really do play an important cultural role in North Korea.
Yes. And we also know, although we can't really trust North Korean statistics, we know that North Korea is either the or among the most literate nations on the earth. Their literacy rate is over 98%. You know, compared to our American literacy, which is what, in the mid 80s or upper 80s. It's one of those things we wouldn't expect of North Korea. But then what occurred to me was, well, of course, if you're using propaganda as a state device, you need a literate population. And one way to make your population literate is really to have them read comic books.
Now, are all the comic books that you've seen coming out of North Korea government approved, I suppose you could say, or is there also a culture of more subversive comic books?
Yeah, this is one of those things I'm curious about myself, but I would guess that if there's subversive cartooning going on in North Korea, it's very, very secretive because, everything is, in fact, controlled by the government. All the printed comics are printed by national presses. Those properties are all owned by the state. And the punishment for any kind of subversion is so extreme that it would have to be done very secretively. And so our chances of finding any of that would be very slim. The things that did come out of the country, I think, on the one hand, are things that they would find, an appealing representation of North Korean ideals. And those are the kinds of books you would see sold in the Chinese cities. The other type of comic book that came out were things that were used in the educational system. So those would clearly be met with state approval because the state was using them for educational purposes. I would love to see some of the subversive comics because the other thing about comic book culture is in every culture that produces comics, there's a kind of indie comic movement. And sometimes those indie comics, I guess the Soviet, former Soviet Union is another parallel. Much of their vital literature was the illegally printed, personally circulated samizdat.
Right.
And that was the great literature of the Soviet era. And I think in North Korea, you probably do have this, but we haven't seen it yet.
I'm curious, have you been to North Korea?
I have not been to North Korea. I have some reservations about going because my father was a sergeant who ran the honor guard at Panmunjom. In South Korea. So in the demilitarized zone, Panmunjom is the area that has the border of North and South Korea running right through the middle of the conference rooms. And on the south side, you have, in those days, the American Army was the one that that was responsible for, I guess, maintaining order there. So my father was the one who handpicked like the 6'4", linebacker type soldier to be a representation of the UN. And of course, in North Korea, they also handpicked their soldiers. And one of the things my father did was he went out of his way to annoy the North Koreans. He was called the Scoundrel Finkel. And In the DMZ, the vehicles are required to fly the UN flag on one side and a white flag, a surrender flag, on the other side of their bumpers to designate them as, you know, peaceful vehicles. And what my father did was, on all of his vehicles, he had the UN flag on one side, and on the other side, instead of the white flag, he had a Jolly Roger. And that was designed specifically to annoy the North Koreans. And he was, so he was called Scoundrel Fenkel, and his unit was called the Hooligans.
So you're worried that, I mean, you're a scholar of Korean culture, but you're worried that something, it might not be altogether safe for you to go to North Korea?
Yeah, it's probably, you know, slightly paranoid, but I have the same name as my father, and the North Koreans keep very detailed records. They would be able to look that up. And my father was at Panmunjom for 2 years in the 70s. I have fond memories of visiting. Since my father worked there, he was able to take me and, you know, take me to the Bridge of No Return and down into the tunnels, the infiltration tunnels that the North Koreans had dug underneath the demilitarized zone. And I still remember looking through those periscope binoculars. And when the North Koreans saw you doing that, they would always make gestures and wave.
So what you're describing is, I mean, very much an artifact of the Cold War. There was, of course, a hot war in, you know, between the two Koreas. But I guess I'm wondering how much that culture still exists.
In North Korea, the Cold War, or actually, I guess you could say the hot war, has never ended. Because even in comic books that came out after the year 2000, what you find is the world is in this curious, continuous war. It's very hard to explain. In fact, I guess the best parallel would be 1984, right? That perpetual war that's going on that keeps the people in a constant state of fear and allows the state to control them.
And this is from the perspective of North Korea,
but
probably not from South Korea, is it?
In South Korea, South Korea is a country that has all sorts of international news. In fact, too much international news, one might even say. Whereas in North Korea, access to any kind of information from the outside is very, very carefully controlled. I mean, they really are the hermit kingdom of Korea. And so for a typical North Korean, the war has never ended. And in fact, the daily life of a North Korean would be very similar to the life of, say, a South Korean or Europeans during World War II. So the scarcity of food, the travel restrictions, all of those things are very characteristic of a state at war.
So I guess the question is whether North Koreans believe this ideology, you might say this propaganda, that comes down from the government. I mean, that North Korea is kind of always threatened by attack. There are these invaders who want to come in and take away precious resources or try to crush the North Koreans themselves. You wonder whether people really believe this.
These days, just in the past 5 years or so, because of things like cell phone technology, a lot of that curtaining has begun to erode. But one of the things very characteristic of refugees from North Korea, and in South Korea there are many of them because the state actually takes care of them. One of the things that's almost universally characteristic of them is they enter a terrible state of depression. And part of it is because there's such a huge cognitive dissonance. They come to South Korea, which the North represents as being developed around what you would think of South Korea being in the 60s. And of course, you know, South Korea is uniformly demonized. So the North Koreans come to the South and they're literally stunned by the level of development, by the amount of material goods that are commonly available, the social freedoms, and they become entirely disoriented. And the response is usually to withdraw and enter a profound depression. This is a very common outcome.
Which is interesting because you might, from a Western perspective, you might think, oh, it would seem very liberating.
Yeah, and I think the reason they enter a depression is because what's really happening is their worldview has been destroyed. And it's, you know, I guess in some ways it would be like, what would happen if you were a devout religious person and you discovered quite literally that there was no God and that Satan was God? You know, it would be that profound a cognitive dissonance. And the North Koreans I've talked to, not refugees, but you know, people who work for the state, these are North Koreans who come out on the mission or academics, or there's actually quite a lot of educational exchange going on right now. It's very optimistic. And one of the things that always puzzled me was, how could an educated person, say an intellectual, really believe in that propaganda, say about the great leader and about Kim Jong-il? Okay. So I asked a couple of them, and I was very surprised because, first of all, they really do believe in that idealism. And a couple of them told me, yes, the facts turn out not to be true, but when I was a child, Kim Il-sung came to my school, and he gave us pencils and paper, and he promised to come back and bring us presents, and he did. And so from the time they were little children, they were actually sort of groomed into seeing the great leader as literally the great leader. So because he followed through on those things that he promised, what happened was, you can sort of project that into larger, you know, scale moral and ethical issues as well. Their visceral connection with him during their formative years was very positive, and therefore they would tend to give him the benefit of the doubt. And and they said later, you know, as they grew up, they were in fact disillusioned, but they couldn't really let go of that because that was built into their whole being. And I guess from our point of view, to imagine a state, you know, using that mechanism seems so nefarious. But at the same time, if you look at Korean culture, like if you're a folklorist, I'm a folklorist, so I look at mythology. What you discover is that is actually very much in keeping with traditional Korean culture and the nation creating mythology that takes it all the way back to its mythic origins as the lineage descended from the son of the sun. And that's what North Korea is doing at a state level.
Fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.